Hello everyone. Welcome to our Skype for Business at Microsoft Subject Matter Expert or SME Roundtable. I'm Sherry Bettine and I'll be your host. We are the IT Showcase team and we love to talk to you about how Microsoft does IT. Today, we have the IT experts that run our Skype for Business technology at Microsoft. This SME Roundtable is your opportunity to ask direct questions and receive candid answers. Now is the time to start submitting your questions through the live Skype Q&A window. We've also collected some of your questions in advance, so we have those on hand as well, and I'll ask your questions anonymously. We'll do our best to get through all of the questions in the next hour. But if we don't, we'll stay back in the studio and continue to answer your questions so that when we post this video, we'll post it with the extended footage with the answers to your questions. You can find this video on Microsoft.com/IT Showcase. Let's start off by letting our experts introduce themselves. And we'll start with you, Casey.
Hi, my name is Casey Han. I've been working for Microsoft for 7 years, and I manage Skype for Business for Link, and especially in enterprise voice side.
Thank you, Casey. Donna?
Hello, my name is Donna Patterson. I'm the Engineering Program Manager for Skype for Business, Client, IM, and Presence.
Hi, I'm Jonathan Clare. I'm a Skype for Business Service Engineer. Been at Microsoft for approximately 5 years, and I specialize in the data and telemetry for Skype for Business.
Thank you. Dwight.
Hi, my name is Dwight Jones, and I'm a service manager for Skype for Business, and I work on and help drive some of the service improvement programs that we work on.
Very good. David.
My name is David Leff. I've been with Microsoft for about 17 years now. I'm responsible for network architecture in Microsoft IT.
Thank you. Kevin.
Hi, I'm Kevin Fanton, a service engineer for video and conferencing. Been with Microsoft for about 2 years now, and I drive service improvement in the video conferencing space.
Excellent. Well, we're ready to get started. So please be submitting your questions, but I'm going to pull our first question from the list of previously submitted. So we're going to go to Casey first, and Casey had the opportunity to prep for this question, so he brought a diagram with him. So please bring the diagram up while I ask the question. KC, unlike the TDM model, SIP trunks are providing services to multiple locations. Can you provide your high availability design?
Sure. So TDM is like all legacy systems, actually all the calls terminating in each site. Unlike that TDM network, the new SIP trunking, all the calls can go to one central site. And we designed the SIP trunking for the multiple sites. We get rid of all the different sites and we migrate all those to two different SBC SIP trunking sites, one in Redmond and one in Charlotte, okay? Also, we had to make sure that the hardware failure will not cause the outage. So we put the two SBC boxes in Redmond and two SBC boxes in Charlotte. So if one of our hardware fails in any of that location, it will fail over to the other site.
Okay, great. There's a second part to that question. Please describe inbound calls failover.
Okay. Even though we have that hardware failure structure by putting multiple hardwares, we gotta make sure that actually the carrier path does not fail if carrier has problem on their side. So what we had is like, we have what they call enterprise diversity, meaning the calls will start coming from carrier side in one location and it fail over to second location. For example, if you look at the diagram, the primary call will come from the Chicago to Redmond. If that fails, the call will start flowing from the Houston to Charlotte, okay? If you go to the next slide, I can show what we are using it. Even though we have that enterprise diversity, we put the additional failover scenarios, which is called what they call switch diversity. And this one will try four different paths. It will try to come from, the call will come from Chicago to Redmond. If that fails, actually the second leg of the call will come from the Houston to Redmond. If that fails because we have problem in Redmond, the call, the inbound will call will redirect from the Chicago to Charlotte, and then if still that fails, it will go to Houston to Charlotte. So we have four different paths to make sure that inbound call will be successfully come to Redmond, I mean Microsoft.
So we don't go with just backup. We have backup of the backup. We made it extra.
So not only SIP chunking from the carrier side, also in our end, we make sure the hardware is also backed up four times.
We don't want to miss our calls.
No, because it's, as I said before, it is supporting more than 50 different United States.
Yeah.
So if that fails, it's like...
And it's business. We're doing business on this.
Correct.
So we want to keep it up.
Yep.
So thank you. For our next question, we'll go to Jonathan. Jonathan, how can you measure user use of video, P2P and conferencing?
So there's a number of ways you can go about measuring the volume of video use with your users. There are some canned reports in the SQL Server reporting services reports that come with your Skype or your Skype for Business deployment. If you turn on those reporting and monitoring, there are some reports that come with that you can look fairly easily by kind of all up usage of your video, or you can look at individual calls or individuals and see how much they're using different modalities, including video, you know, audio, app sharing, instant messaging. But if you have a little more technical skill in the SQL side, you can dig into the actual SQL data and pull out, you know, any kind of report or any kind of data that you want on all up usage, trend over time, subsets or groups of your users. But the main source for that is going to be in the CDR, the call detail record database. So if you have the ability or someone that can dig in straight into those databases and those tables, you can pull up all kinds of the session data and pull out which sessions included video, which ones didn't.
And does it give quality? So you get some quality data about the calls?
Yeah, the quality doesn't come from the call detail record database. The quality side comes from the QoE, the quality of experience. So you can get the volume from either one. So if you want volume and quality, then stick with the QoE, because that will give you a lot of that volume plus the metrics that go along with each one of those sessions. Either one of those databases can give you the volume, but
there's a lot of data out there.
There's a ton of data. There's absolutely a ton of data, and there's some easier ways to access it through the canned reports and some of our new tools, like the call quality dashboard that's now available, and hopefully a lot of you guys are already digging in and using that. But also all that data still relies on those core SQL CDR database and QoE database. That's where it all starts.
Great, thank you. We have a related question for Kevin. What is the required bandwidth for video conferencing?
I get this a lot. It all depends on frame rate, resolution, and quality, and it also depends on the type of network you're on. We have in our environment immersive video suites, and those can consume as low as a 1 meg all the way up to 16 megs per connection. Looking at the Skype for Business client, the way that works is it has what is called an H.264 protocol, and it's a scalable protocol in which, depending on the type of device you're using, whether it be a workstation or a cell phone, it scales accordingly. So it doesn't, a smaller device is not going to consume as much information as a larger device. And there's also conferencing policies that what we can do is what they call it, the resolution bit. We can set that. And what that'll end up doing is in our environment, we'll set it for low resolution it starts this way, and it can scale up on a cell phone. But as far as like a desktop, we start at like the high end, the 1080p, and then if the bandwidth constraints are there, it'll scale down. We sacrifice resolution over frame rate on that because we start with like 30 frames per second, and if we drop below 15, that's when we'll start seeing breaks in the audio, and in the video, and that's what we don't want to see.
So it sounds like it's smart enough to work with the bandwidth that you have available to you.
And it is. The device it's you very have scalable, the H.264.
And you probably start it somewhere that matches what Microsoft's network environment can handle. So you probably are able to configure it in advance?
Correct. There's some policies that we can put out there. The biggest challenges that I see is mobile users in the field, spotty cell coverage, spotty Wi-Fi coverage. That's where we'll start seeing some of those problems arise. But with that H.264 protocol, it dynamically adjusts to your connections.
Okay, great. Thank you. So we'll go to Donna with the next question. Donna, what are the differences with Skype for Business across the different mobile platforms?
Well, first I'd like to say that often we do not have parity or the same features that exist across the Windows Phone. We had 8.1. Now we've introduced Windows 10 phones. We have the Skype iOS and we have Android. So obviously on the Windows Phone, you can do a lot more, a lot of the features that works with your Office suites, your app sharing, your PowerPoint viewing and video and content. With the Android and iOS that we just launched this fall and the holiday season, we are still limited around content for some of the Android, and also we're about to reintroduce the app sharing for the iOS. You can get your contacts in your Windows Phone as well as some of your Androids, and we're working to return the contacts into the iOS or have feature parity where all of them can do the same thing. And in the future, which we get a lot of feedback around, is trying to get the capability to forward in the iOS client. If you're in your iOS phone and you look up to the top right, you can share the link of any of your meetings, but you can't forward any type of agenda or any attachments that's in your meeting and that content. And that's some of the big differences that we see that a lot of our business as well as our consumer users want to see.
And we're working on getting
that. And we're working on that. Yes.
Okay, great. Thank you. We have a follow-up to Kevin's question earlier. What is the best way to limit someone's video quality if they are on a bandwidth restricted network?
The best thing to do is look at maybe some type of policies to restrict the users at what is called the bit rate, which I was talking about before, is if you have those bandwidth constraints, look at lowering the bit rates. So this way the user has a better experience.
Okay, so you can set that in advance.
Right,
within conferencing. So that they never get the higher bandwidth.
Right, within conferencing policies, we can set that up. Within our immersive video suites, too, sometimes we have some constraints on bandwidth from remote users coming in. What we'll end up doing is we'll throttle it down to where we can still do HD quality video at like 720p, but it's at 15 frames versus the 30 standard frames that we typically do for HD video.
Yeah, and it's also it's not always perfect, but the Skype client, especially on the desktop, will try to automatically scale these things like Kevin already said, but it will scale it all the way to the point where it'll shut off video if it feels like the audio is being compromised.
Right. So audio is king.
Yep, so audio is king, and if anything else with app sharing or video starts to get in the way, you know, it's not always seamless, and so it's not always perfect, but the design is to scale that down to a certain point, and once it kind of reaches a point of no return, it'll actually shut the whole thing off and keep the audio up, and the user will get a little notification that says they don't have enough. I can't remember the exact words, but it'll basically tell them they don't have enough bandwidth to,
right.
to you know, enjoy all these other features and yeah. just.
But at least the conversation
the audio.
Can
yep.
right. continue.
So the conversation needs to continue.
We business. Don't see it a lot, and then when it gets really bad, then we get that audio degradation on top of it. So you got to be on a really bad connection before that starts tanking at that point, and you don't get audio on top of it. So.
Okay. Great. Next question is for Dwight.
Mm-hmm.
Dwight, what are some of the challenges faced with supporting the server environment for Skype for Business?
Okay, good question. And as you can reference in the architectural discussion, a lot of the lessons learned that we had was around making sure that you have the right capacity for your environment, the way that you manage the health end-to-end, and how do you control change in your environment. Those have been some of our challenges, particularly at Microsoft, with us being first and best and running multiple instances in the past where we've had Link as well as Skype for Business as we made our migrations. We had to make sure that we had the right amount of capacity, a good migration plan for upgrading and migrating. And those are some of the challenges that we've had in the server space. But as we manage the end-to-end health and change and capacity, those are the key things that we can do to make sure our environment is running effectively.
Did we start with sufficient server capacity, or did we try do a trial and error, try one size and then?
Well, and you have to look at it from our perspective that, you know, Microsoft, we are first and best. So we need to get things right in our environment before we productize.
Before it goes out. So we're the guinea pigs.
We're the guinea pigs. And if I can expand a little bit more, you know, we have been first and best from migrating from the Link 2013 environment to the Skype for Business environment, as well as to the cloud environment. And, you know, we've migrated 220,000 users in a short amount of time, so we can take that journey, so we can share our story with our customers.
Right, and we can improve the product so that it is ready for our customers.
Absolutely.
Great. Thank you. Question. Would you ever provide the capability to allow MDM vendors to leverage container technology to secure the Skype mobile app? Today, the only option is VPN or per app, and I'm not sure who the right.
I'll take it because it's very easy. We actually were in Microsoft IT, so that's not something that we actually are able to answer. That's going to be on the dev, the product group side.
Okay.
We're not the ones that actually get to have the fun of making the apps and designing the technologies and how that works there. So that one's going to be for our partner group, our product group partners.
Okay.
Sorry about that.
Yeah, and sometimes there are questions about where the technology is going, and we don't always have insights into that. What we do have insights into is how we're leveraging it here at Microsoft, the capabilities that come to us.
Yeah.
And we do try and influence the product. When we see features that we need, an enterprise organization would need in the product, we funnel those back.
We don't just try it. It's part of our daily job.
Absolutely.
Part of our life cycle is, as White said, first and best means the first customer and hopefully the best customer. Part of the life cycle is that we get that stuff early, drive improvements back into the product, and then out to the customers, and then we talk to customers like you guys, and then we get that input from you as well, and it all just works hopefully to improve the product and improve everyone's experience.
We make sure it's enterprise ready. We are going to go to a question for David. David, do we use ExpressRoute here at Skype for Business?
We do. So if you're on our corporate intranet and going to a Microsoft Public Cloud service, including Skype for Business, there are two primary paths that you can take. You can take the Internet Edge. So we have a default route to an Internet Edge that will transport you to any destination that is not on our intranet. That's one way to get to the public cloud services. The other way would be through a specific ExpressRoute peering to Azure, to Office 365, and now to Skype for Business as well. The primary benefits and the reasons why we're gravitating toward ExpressRoute in the locations where you have a high concentration of users is I can do some interesting traffic engineering. I can provide dedicated capacity. I can preserve the quality of service because they will honor our code points and they will honor our type of service.
We can decide. Gets priority.
And when it comes back from the service, that code point is already set so that as that traffic propagates through our intranet, we do the right thing with it on our network from a quality of service perspective. And the last one's interesting, but is not always obvious to people. If I have a unique path for a specific destination service, I can apply a unique security policy to that. And I can start to remove a lot of the security controls and the security inspection that we do that can be not only a performance impact, but also it has a direct proportion to your cost. So if I don't need to inspect that traffic, I don't need to do some of those more expensive security operations, I can actually take it off that path.
And this is how we provide quality service at dedicated without all the bandwidth eating security inspections. Okay. Sounds good. So where? How many locations have we implemented?
Right now, we have it implemented in one location.
Redmond?
Essentially Redmond, for basically Puget Sound. Mm-hmm. But that express route path can be potentially used by all of North America. So we'll have strategic geographic locations where we have an express route peering, and we'll also take that, of course, to Asia Pacific and Europe when the time's right.
Okay. So it's kind of in the plans, in our future plans?
It's in the plans. It's part of our edge networking suite. And again, it's going to be handled on kind of a service-by-service basis.
Based on when they reach that level of volume?
When they reach the volume, when it makes sense from a service delivery perspective, and it makes sense with the way that our internal network topology is designed.
Okay, great. Thank you. Another question. Today, is it possible to incorporate Skype contacts in Skype for Business? Sometimes the Yammer tool will be integrated, Does Skype offer language translator?
Skype director.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, in your Skype for Business client, you actually can do your Skype search, and you can also do a search for your Skype buddies or your Skype contacts. Mm-hmm. And if they don't have something common and similar, because you can potentially get an error that says it pulled up too many of in your search. But yes, you can search from your Skype for Business client into the Skype Consumer for a buddy contact and vice versa. You can pull them in a call, I'm in presence with them, but they do not get the richness of the features of obviously Skype for Business. And was there another part of that?
Does Skype offer language translator?
Yes, we can. We do offer a language translator in there. And that is actually something that we've recently dog food, but we should be rolling out the full completed version.
So in that one, press kind of was released on what the language translation capabilities of the Skype consumer client are with that full immersive video. You know, I'm on a video call with someone else talking in a different language, and I'm actually hearing them talk, and then a voice comes on and translates it in real time. That's not currently integrated into the Skype for Business client. What Dawn is referring to is at each IM, it's a message that you type. When it's released publicly, it'll have a little button that says show translation or translate.
Yeah, I've seen
and
that.
I can click that button, and it'll do a text translation to whatever language you have set up in your settings previously. So we do have that going already, but that full immersive video live translation, that's not in there yet. And we hope to have that. We don't have any timelines for that or anything, but it's a really awesome feature of the Skype consumer client that we'd love to see in the enterprise version as well.
So text coming, we're dog fooding text.
Yes.
And coming
soon. Depending on what your release cycle is and where you are as a customer, you know, some of them may already start to see that right now.
The early adopters may have
that. So that's a setting within the Skype client then, correct? Or is that per device? Okay.
It's within
it's the not a server client. Setting then?
No, you'll see it in the settings will be able to be manipulated by each individual on their own client.
At the individual level, not the enterprise.
Okay, great. Okay. Thanks. How many users do we have located on premises versus Skype for Business online?
I think I can take that one.
Okay.
Right. So we have 178,000 that are still in our on-premise environment today, and roughly around 27,000 that are in our cloud environment. Where we are going forward, we have built out the capacity to support 100,000 in the cloud. And we are looking to start those migrations. Actually, they have already started as we speak, and we're looking to scale very rapidly in our cloud environment. And the end goal is by FY17, we want 90% of our users to be in the cloud environment.
Great. And we're always going to hold a few back just because we want to make sure that on-premise is dog fooding.
Yeah, we obviously have customers that will be at a different run rate than we are. And so we want to make sure that we have the support infrastructure for our customers that will have the on-prem environment. And so we will keep both environments up and operational so we can support customers that will be running a server-side environment.
Can I expand on that? Yes.
Sure.
To Dwight, yes, we do have on-premise, hybrid, and also in the cloud, but also even at the client level. We have some clients out there that have not transitioned off 2010, and that's not a regression statement. Mm-hmm. Some out there are 2013, and some of them have not even obviously looked to the Skype for Business. For whatever technical debt that company has, and wherever we're trying to meet and support their needs at all those different levels, whether it's on-prem, hybrid, or in the cloud,
yep.
And at the client level, we're supporting them, because if I am company A, small business, don't have the funding to transition to that newer client version, I want my sales support structure and team that I'm potentially paying for to be able to reproduce what I'm seeing in my experience and to help facilitate resolution and closure of the root cause. So yeah. We are more of a panacea of different environments, yeah. And different views to the customer so that we can better support them.
Yeah, we have over 200 different client versions, yeah. That connect to our infrastructure every day.
Yep.
So that's from 2010 and up to Skype for Business clients that no one's ever seen yet except for, you know, the people who are literally making them right now.
Yep.
So we have a lot of diversity in our environment to deal with.
Okay, great. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Follow along to that is, as you think about end user change management, moving from traditional phone and PBX setup to using Skype for Business client, what are some of your key learnings to help end users adopt Skype for Business and be productive?
I'm going to let you handle that from the phone piece, and then I'll dive into the client piece readiness.
So what we did is from when we switch from PBX to Skype for Business, we make sure their dialing experience same as before. Like, for example, if you're used to dialing 9 to call out, we made the dial plan which you translate 9 and then get rid of 9 and put it into what the Skype for Business,
yeah,
can handle.
There's a lot of people who think that you have to dial 9 to dial out of Microsoft still. You have it for probably 8 years.
More than that.
Right, but if they still pressed it, they
but
it
worked.
It out.
They
don't press it, they do press it.
But they're shocked when you show them that you don't actually have to do it. We actually dummied it in there so they would.
Because
they
we tried to.
Either way.
Because if you're like new to Microsoft,
yep.
If they're used to using dial 9 or 8, or they use like special code to go out, we made sure that it will work no matter how they dial. So
right. If they add a 1 sometimes,
yep,
they don't add a 1.
Exactly. Frequency. Same thing. Sometimes they dial 1 prior people like 4 to 5 numbers. And some people, like, for example, a lot of people are used to using 7-digit dialing, and we made it works. Like, for example, if somebody calling Redmond site, they don't have to type 4 to 5. And this can be done inside your dial plan in Skype for Business, and we can translate it correctly.
And then I'm going to take the piece of it from the client. Oftentimes I take a lot of my calls from my iOS client, from my mobile client that has Skype for Business. And with preparation of readiness and ensuring what is that experience, when you're trying to set your end user up, always offer to them what are the standard features or offerings that they'll see, set them up for what that experience is, and then give them what I'd say is some tips and tricks, the things that they're going to most commonly use. So when I'm using my iOS client for Skype for Business, I know that I can't forward my meetings and do some of the things I want, but we did turn on a feature where you can share the link and you may not have the content. Or when you're looking at the content and what are you viewing, you can also put in your settings where you set that for content, I want this Wi-Fi only and whatever, to make sure that you're maximizing, potentially using Wi-Fi if you're in a strong network area, or if you're using your data, you know that they could potentially charge it. So I think with dealing with using any client, especially Skype for Business, set up the readiness and communication mm-hmm. to help teach and train and educate them on what their experience would be and give them tips and tricks to be productive during the day.
And I'm going to put in a plug mm-hmm. for our own Work Smart team or productivity guides.
Mm-hmm.
What Donna is talking about, we have done for our users here, and we, the IT Showcase team, like to provide these to our users so that they can take our productivity guides and use them in their own organization. So what Donna has just described is available to you to use for your own employees. So at Microsoft.com/ITShowcase, search for productivity, and you will find the productivity guides that you can use.
And they exist for all of the mobile clients, Windows, obviously iOS, and Android.
Yep. One of the other things that's easy to do or is part of the decision process as you make that transition is to decide how you're going to roll it out and what kind of headsets or soft phones, desk phones you're going to use. So it's going to be very dependent on kind of what your environment is and what your work culture is, because there are devices that you can set on someone's desk. If all your workers are used to having a desk phone that they can pick up and press buttons, you can still do that. You can still have a USB or even a network integrated desk phone sitting on a desk where their calls in, calls out will feel virtually exactly the same as what they're used to from a PBX, traditional telephone. But for that mobile experience, and you want to, people are used to using the client on the screen, give them a headset. They have that full, rich environment on the, on the screen. They can see all the screen sharing and the video. It doesn't take a lot for people to transition to that once they start to get excited about those features and realize that, it's much more than just a desk phone with a handset and some buttons. Like when you get into that rich environment, video chatting, large conferences, instant messaging, all the screen sharing, app sharing. I mean, it's a pretty immersive experience, and once people get into that, I think it's easier to make that transition. But you can baby step them along the way, and have some of your workforce use one and some of it use another, and kind of design that whatever fits for your company.
And test them out. Do some test cases.
Just to pair on just a little bit, because I know that John, you run the Skype for Business logo program to make sure that they are using certified devices, but ensuring that those IT managers can you come up with what is the minimum viable product in terms of a remote user, what is the right headset, we're even looking at, routers. Good Wi-Fi routers for them to have, and, mm-hmm. and like you said, the small, medium, and large conference room.
Yes, please use a headset or a certified device of some kind.
It'd be a better
It doesn't
experience.
Have to be the $300 one, it can be a $30 one. It is the biggest factor, other than the network itself, the biggest factor in your quality of experience is using some type of headset.
Yeah, right. You've seen it where not just you know when they're not using an approved headset and they have a bad experience. Yeah. It just shows on those reports. Just
and the approved ones have been tested and optimized.
There's a certification program.
Yes. Then one step further too, make sure the drivers are up to date on your devices. We see that sometimes that causes a problem. A lot of issues with remote users, mobile users at home with their, like Dwight said, the Wi-Fi. Mm-hmm. They could have an older device, and there are streaming items on there, like Netflix, and it's just tanking their calls, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we put that Work Smart guide together.
Router guide.
And we suggest that you do that too. You go demo some of those devices, see how your calls are, make some recommendations to the mobile users. Especially when they're out of town too. We got the sales force, they're in hotels, and we give them the best practices.
Yeah.
What to do and what not to do. If you get a wired connection,
based on the different circumstances of the calls.
Yep. That's a good lead in, and Donna talked about the tips and tricks mm-hmm. to make sure that your users are aware of what would be expected behavior if you're in a hotel lobby, right. You don't have a headset.
Educate
to
them.
Educate the users, make sure they know.
Didn't do that, right? Yeah. And so we're wondering, why is this call really bad? And then we started digging into it.
Yep.
Jonathan's like, they're on wireless and they're pretty much at the edge of the cell coverage.
Yep.
And the call volume.
And that one user can tank a 200 user phone call if they don't know.
And even if they're worse enough, they're even hosting it, right?
Yeah.
Hosting it on wireless.
On wireless.
On a hotel.
In a car.
Not good. Not good.
Cellular.
Okay. We have a couple more questions, and I'm just going to couch these questions as we do work closely with the product group, and sometimes we know when we can disclose information and when we can't. So I can't guarantee we can answer either of the next two questions, but we will ask them. Do you plan to provide Skype for Business for iMac? Today we can only use Link. Do we have any knowledge?
For Mac.
For Mac client, mm-hmm. it's being reviewed and evaluated. Currently, this Link 2011 for the Mac client is what we're using now until further notice that the PG communicates to it and shares.
Okay, great. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Next question. Can you comment on the next version of on-premise Skype for Business? Will it continue to be cumulative updates, or will there be a new version that is not an in-place upgrade?
I'll take half of that. We've made a change internally within Microsoft where we went to 3 to 4 branches. And I say 3 to 4 because we have 3 internal and then there's an external branch. And what we've done is each branch receives features at different rates and times. So the first branch, which is the first release, current branch we call it, and it's our elite users, those who are dog food and testing everything, they will get updates at a more frequently monthly update. They will obviously get the standard security updates. Then we have a current branch that may get it 2 to 3 months later and so on at set frequencies. So those different branches will get different features at different times, and we've moved some of our customers to more less updates but more security and things like that. So we will definitely have different upgrade rates based on the different branch users, but our TAP community will always still get it kind of first with us.
Yeah, but from the client side or the service?
From the client side, from the client
side. So to answer the question about, I think, from the server perspective mm-hmm. and the overall releases, and we can't actually comment on that. We what will happen in the future with the Skype for Business on-premises releases, we don't know. Right now, we are very strongly focused on the cloud and moving our users to the cloud mm-hmm. and getting as many customers into the cloud as we can. We believe that's the future. We also mm-hmm. understand, though, that there are going to be companies that either cannot or won't follow us there. And there's, right now we still have restrictions in certain countries that will, just straight can't allow that to happen at this point. So it's the Skype for Business on-premises is not going away.
Yep.
That is for sure, but we can't comment on what the next version is going to be.
But I do think that it's important to say that, we still will be making improvements to the product through cumulative updates, and if there are bugs and if there are requests, that those things will happen. We know that from a cloud perspective that Skype for Business is now being offered as a part of the O365 E5 offering, and that's our focus, like you said, from the cloud migration standpoint. Mm-hmm.
Okay, great. Thank you. We'll pose our next question to David. What do you mean when you talk about an optimized security policy?
Okay. Optimized security policy would be something like, for example, on our internet edge, we have traditional firewalling, we have reputational-based blocking, we have intrusion detection / prevention, we have data loss prevention. We also do other types of inspection for things like advanced malware analysis, advanced persistent threat protection. We have to do that on edges where the destination is unknown. So it could be anything. It could be Microsoft. It could be not Microsoft. It could be a file, file repository, download point. It could
be when we're going out.
Anything. We're going out, outbound in this case. We have to have that whole complement of security capabilities on that default internet edge. When I build a service-specific edge to a known destination like Skype for Business or Office 365, some of that functionality may be baked into the cloud service platform itself. So I can actually take that out of the network. In some in some destination services, there's not even that possibility or not that risk doesn't exist. So in that case also, I can take it out. And that's what I mean about optimizing our security capabilities on service-specific edges.
So we stay secure, but we use the minimum amount of security required.
The right amount of security.
Right. Right. Yes. We stay secure. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Correct. Yes.
So minimum is a subjective term.
Right. Right.
The right is also a subjective term. That will continue to change over time.
But the right doesn't mean throw everything that we have in our security arsenal.
But it's more in like layers as well, too, correct?
It's layers as well. It may mean throw everything at it that you have. But as we're seeing, you know, the cloud service providers start to take more responsibility for that security posture, or they start to remove some of the risks, we're going to take it out of our edge.
So it's still there. It's just who
it's there where it needs to be.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
And a lot of it's built into the product as well.
Yes. So.
All right, let's go to Kevin. Is video error correction included in the video payload bitrate for peer-to-peer communications?
Yes, it is included in the payload. The way the client works is it doesn't always constantly stream audio and video at the same time. What that means is it's dynamic. So with the audio portion of that, what happens is when the user speaks, that's when the stream is transmitted. The receivers always receive those streams, but when you get to the video, within a peer-to-peer, video is always streaming on both participants. What happens is when there's changes in the actual video stream, where the bit rate drops is when there's not much change in the actual image. So if there's not a lot of movement, there's not a lot of decoding and encoding. And so what happens is the bit rate goes down. That's pretty much.
So if it's like if you're staying still, it kind of can freeze that image and worry about other things.
Right. So if there's movement within the image, it'll go ahead and encode and decode that. So this way, you're not transmitting as much bandwidth on that wire, so it's just dynamically adjusting.
To optimize for the experience.
Correct.
Okay. Great.
And there's a, you know, there's also within the conferencing space as well, when you do regular conferencing, not peer-to-peer, what ends up happening is it follows the same where audio is transmitted when the user speaks and all participants receive audio. The change is when you get your video stream. So what happens is the remotes will get like five streams of video and then one panoramic view. It's by active speaker, so it adjusts the bandwidth as well too. You have controls in there. You can select which stream you want. You can pick which user you want to view. But by default, it's always active speaker.
If you wanted to lock it versus having it rotate.
And for error correction, right, it scales up and scales down
scales
as needed.
Up and down, okay. And it's based on, again, the bit rate with the conferencing policy. So you can set it the highest if you know that you have that available bandwidth. We set it there. It goes back to that same question before where we start with devices that can do 1080p, 30 frames per second, you want to get high def video, we'll do that. But when you're on a mobile device, maybe on a cellular network, it's intelligent enough to say, I'm only going to push maybe 720p and maybe 16 frames per second.
Got it.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I'm going to go back to KC. And you talked about earlier your inbound calls fell over. Could you talk a little bit about outbound calls failover?
Sure. So outbound failover is done by the system engineer side. Inbound call is done by carriers. So carrier determines which call path comes in. For inbound calls, we can control it using voice policies and PS10 routes. So what we usually do is like for in our case, we put the call through Redmond circuit first. It hit the Redmond SBC first, and it fails in any reason because of hardware failure or carrier failure, it will go to the next route, which goes to Charlotte automatically. So if the circuit or hardware fails, inbound and both outbound will failover automatically. So a lot of times when we have problem in like the hardware failure, we don't even notice until next time because the inbound and outbound will fail over to another side without doing anything.
It works well. It's not obvious to the
very
end
seamless.
User.
So you have multiple failovers, right, site and then connections. Great.
That's great. So that works real time, but it also would work if we were to have a true disaster somewhere.
Correct.
So having it, the redundancy in the real time system gives you that disaster recovery ability as well.
As Casey was saying before, the one of, between the TDM and the SIP, the benefit is you in that TDM you have all of the different sites individually have to have their own you know, telephony infrastructure, their own PBX, their own carrier taps in, you know, to ingress and egress from each individual site. That's a lot of hardware. That's a lot of technicians that have to be able to be available for support, you know, geographically distributed. And that SIP allows us to centralize everything into one or, in our case, two spots. That is a huge benefit for us, but that also creates a single point of failure in a way where, you know, if one building in one city goes out before, that didn't affect anyone else in the rest of the country or world. Now, if I have the SIP go down, that's all the sites in America or the U.S. or, you know, what, you know, in the North America or, you know, however you have it distributed. So it's very important to have that kind of redundancy and that failover and that, that high availability because, yes, you centralize it, made it easier to manage. I only have to have engineers or technicians to, you know, in a single site or maybe two sites as opposed to 50 or 60. But if one of those goes down, the whole thing goes down. So that's, you know, that is why we also have to right size our security and our availability for those disaster scenarios or, you know, the carrier has a problem. You know, a lot fewer variables that could take down the whole system instead of, you know, these small little small failures that wouldn't have as big of an impact.
Yeah, redundancy is good.
Yes. Yep. Well worth it.
I'm going to go back to Dwight. You talked earlier about Get to Green. Could you expand a little bit more on what kind of improvements we needed to make?
Absolutely. Let me tee it up a little bit and say that, you know, when Microsoft acquired Skype in 2011, you know, we were still running a purely link shop. And so that was a lot of work that had to be done to integrate the two platforms. And and with the challenges there as we were migrating from, you know, 2010 to 2013 and eventually to Skype for Business, you know, we were challenged like most IT shops to, you know, make sure that we were purchasing for the right things in terms of hardware capacity, how we upgrade it. You know, another big paradigm shift that we have is the use of a wireless infrastructure. Back during that time, you know, most form factors supported hardwired wired connections. And so, you know, bringing in all these factors, the acquisition of Skype, the server hardware that was standard at that time, and the wireless infrastructure, we had some challenges in our environment keeping up with the changes such as BYOD and things of that nature. And with that, that came the Get to Green program, which was a seven-pillar program where we wanted to improve our network and client network and server stability, client stability, incident and change management, conferencing, media quality, and as well as how do we do dog food and release into the environment. And out of that, you know, it was a broad effort across Microsoft, the PG side and the IT side. You know, we were able to, you know, bring the Skype for Business product to fruition, do our first cloud deployment. We were able to improve poor call quality. You know, we were suffering around 8%, and I think we hit a bottom point of improving the poor call quality in our environment to 1.73%. And, you know, we're continuing that program as we work on driving single point of failure improvements into our environment, making sure that we have the right capacity and driving end-to-end health items and solving for the end user. So that's what that is.
Oh, that sounds like a great improvement.
And we have done a lot of good collaborative work across this team and a lot of others that aren't represented here to, you know, one, bring the Skype for Business product forward, but also to drive a number of improvements into the product so that our customer end user will be able to appreciate them. You know, without, and let us take
so
the
we head, love the headaches.
Yeah, I love the improvements that we've made today and that we continue to drive as we operationalize and productize those improvements.
Great. Can I spin on that? We also, from those, the work and the relationships, we were able to partner with PG on the I Am in Presence. And we introduced the Auto Accept earlier, and we actually put that across all the clients so that, quote unquote, no IMs were being not delivered. And what we found out in drilling down and partnering with PG was that was a potentially erroneous error. It wasn't that it was not delivered as if there was no storage out there space. It was if you have not accepted or acknowledged that instant message in 25 seconds, it timed out. So we had to do research and partner with PG and say, hey, this isn't optimal. It's sending the wrong message to our internal end users, so we know it's getting confused. Thus, the question was, hey, why don't you have server-side storage for instant messages? Well, you're getting 130 million a month instant messages. Are you really going to put storage in for that? And the answer is no. So we were able to partner, improve that, improve our inset, and then start improving because of that, of all the modalities, instant messages is the highest one used.
Yeah, let me, the inset, and then I think that's a key point, the customer satisfaction, right? And talking about those service improvements, which, you know, IM and presence is the highest improved one, right? And just going back to the Get to Green and the service improvement efforts, you know, we still have a lot of work to do to drive the improvements in the product, but Microsofties take a satisfaction survey that's sent out across the world, and Skype for Business, our user satisfaction from the internal users is up double digits across all measured environments. So we're very proud of the ground that we're taking for driving improvements. You know, we have a long way to go, but it shows the value and of this work.
Way.
Absolutely.
Yep. I just want to say PG is product group.
Sorry. Yes.
And we are near the end of our hour. Mm-hmm. So I would like to pose one final question of our SMEs. And that is, you guys are our Skype for Business experts. So what is one tip you would like to leave our customers with today? And can we start with you, Kevin?
Yeah, so if you don't have video turned on right now and you're thinking about it, what I would suggest is setting up a pilot. Add a conference room if you don't have that with video. Look at how users are adopting that. If they're turning on their video, you look at your bandwidth requirements. Like I said, you don't have to have big pipes to do it. You just have to manage those pipes. And to also, what we've been doing is on some of these low bandwidth connections, we have implemented like quads. So we're actually doing markings on voice and video to improve the experience. So don't be afraid to turn on the video, but do it in steps to where you can monitor it and see if you're actually impacting, you know, the voice side of the equation. So that's what I would recommend.
Thanks, Kevin. David.
My item expands on something that Kevin and Dwight talked about, which is best practices and paying attention to what's going on closer to the end client. So a lot of times when we had reports of experience or performance issues, we took an outside-in approach to diagnosing the problem. We looked at the service and the network, and we didn't see an obvious problem. And a lot of people that were using that shared infrastructure weren't experiencing the same issue. So it ended up being they were running applications on the client that was consuming the network stack, that was consuming the interface bandwidth, that was consuming the amount of capacity they had at the access point, whether it was wired or wireless. You know, a browser window in the background playing a video that you're not aware of, or a rotating ad can cause some performance issues. In a home setting, you know, people playing Xbox or, you know, streaming a movie on the local area network can also cause problems. So people aren't always aware of, and it's not always obvious what's going on the client and what's going on in the local environment that can affect your quality service.
We endorse playing Xbox, for the record.
Yeah. My key is to be
priority traffic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You just
may
not
want
to play Xbox while you're trying to do a call.
Or your family is playing it on the same access point.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. We love Windows 10, but you probably shouldn't be downloading Windows 10 when you're, you know, trying to have a video call.
Absolutely.
Good point. Good tip. Yep.
Thank you, David and Dwight.
Yeah. So, you know, I think we're going to all piggyback off of each other, right? And we talked about some of the things that we did in the infrastructure to drive single point of failure improvements, reliability and availability from that perspective. But, you know, my challenge is to IT managers to take that outside in look in terms of, you know, you're going to have to make those recommendations to your users for the right wireless access point, the right devices to use to make that, the right readiness and education to make the right decisions to have the experience that they want.
And sometimes they're not going to have a good experience based on
if they're working over cellular or, you know, set that expectations. And, you know, we know that if we use our cell phone and while we're driving, we expect that to cut off at certain points in dark and
they should know spots. That.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yep. Thank you. Jonathan.
Yes. One of the things I would suggest is that there to remember there's a lot of data that comes in for every Skype for Business call, video conference, peer-to-peer, anything you do on the Skype for Business client. There's a lot of data that is collected on the client itself and then shipped to the server. There's a lot of cool new tools out there. You know, if you remember my session, we talked a lot about the call quality dashboard, the CQD, that's available now. That is a huge step forward in taking that data, the quality data, and turning it into a cube, a multidimensional cube, and being able to slice and dice it in different ways and visualize it in a much easier way than we've ever been able to do before. Since we taped that, we've actually purchased technology from the company Event Zero, and their tool called the UC Commander. You know, I encourage you to take a look at the capabilities of that. You can still look that up and see. We haven't integrated it into anything, into our product quite yet. And the way we do that might be a more phased approach, and I don't really know when that's going to be publicly available from Microsoft, but it's still currently a product, and to be able to see the kind of stuff, the more real-time data collecting, the combination of that CDR and QoE that we talked about before, all into one tool, and where we're going with the data and analytics and the intelligence you can get about your users and about your deployment, to either know kind of whatever you know how it's going, and then drive improvements where you need them. Mm-hmm. We are light years ahead of where we were just 2 or 3 years ago, and we're only focusing more and more on that. So I would suggest dig in, and if you're frustrated about what you have available now, you know, help
more
and
is
hope is coming. You know, hope is coming. Help is coming. Yeah.
Yep.
Have hope.
Thank you, Jonathan. Donna.
For me, I'm going to say you've made a decision to deploy Skype for Business, and what do you need to do? The biggest thing with the deployment is having a plan of what features you're going to deploy at the enterprise level and what's going to be able to be controlled at the end user level. And take another step back is as you're trying to come up with that all up plan on trying to validate or trying to share the expected experience, think of scenario-based experiences. And that's something we're really getting off into. So am I the salesperson, that road warrior that's taking my calls 90% of the time? I'm mobile, I'm remote. Am I that remote employee who's working from my home? Mm-hmm. Or am I remote because I'm working out in a field office? Understand the expected experience, good, better, best at all those, and help set the expectation for the end user mm-hmm. from a scenario based how they're using it. Are they going to be sitting at their desk all the time, so they need to be hardwired? So these are some of the things just to consider when you're trying to just transition from Link 2013 to Skype for Business and you're trying to deploy Skype for Business. What features are you going to turn on at the enterprise or at the individual level, and help them understand the expectation and how you're going to go about deploying it with best tips and tricks.
Thank you, Donna. And KC.
Yeah. Our team manages 500 devices in like 200 plus countries and 200 different size. And we cannot really monitor all those devices at the same time. And a lot of times it's like 95% of failure is happening on the network level, not the Skype for Business services. So what we did was we created a simple ping tools. We are pinging every device in like 5 minutes interval. And if it fails like three times in a row, we automatically send the notification to network team. And network team will investigate first because, you, as I said before, 95% of our failure is happening network level.
These are for our voice gateway devices.
Right, yeah. Voice gateways and actual.
Not across the board. So let's be clear on that. Yeah.
Okay, thank you, Casey. And we are now at the top of our hour, a little over. So I first want to thank our SMEs for taking time away from your day jobs, coming here to talk to our customers. Thank you very much. And thank you for joining us at our customers, wherever you are. We really enjoy the questions and the dialogue and talking with you about the work that we do here at Microsoft. This video and future SME roundtables, as well as other webinars and technical case studies, lots of content at our Microsoft.com WAC IT Showcase site. We are here to help you be successful with Microsoft technology. Absolutely. So thank you and have a great day, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.